Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode of All the President's Minutes is brought to you by Bella Catering. BellaCatering.com.au is where you can find them. They're one of Sydney's best catering companies. And since the absolute gargantuan shit show of 2020 has descended upon us like one of those spaceships in Independence Day, and COVID-19 has changed our lives, these guys have pivoted from being one of the best face-to-face catering companies in all of Sydney to home delivery and creating just amazing stuff that you can order, you can take home, you can chuck in a freezer. And it's why cook if you're gonna have people over? I know that it's tough to even like think of having people over. You got to worry about hand sanitizers and temperature checks, and does this person have a mask, and really, is that relative of mine that clean? Do you want to invite them? Maybe you want to change it. Don't think about anything else except for that invite list. Order from Bella Catering. If you're in the greater Sydney area, they can help you. They're a great family business. They're part of our little family here at 18 Minute Productions. Thank you for listening. Now onto the show.
I am my brother's keeper. And when you say the name Jacob Blake, make sure you say father, make sure you say cousin, make sure you say son, make sure you say uncle, but most importantly, make sure you say human. Human life. Let it marinate in your mouth, in your minds. A human life. Just like every single one of y'all. And everywhere around the world, we're human. And his life matters. So many people have reached out to me telling me they're sorry that this happened to my family. Well, don't be sorry, because this has been happening to my family for a long time, longer than I can account for. It happened to Emmett Till. Mm. Emmett Till is my family. Mm. Philando, Mike Brown. Sandra, this has been happening to my family, and I've shed tears for every single one of these people that it's happened to. This is nothing new. I'm not sad. I'm not sorry. I'm angry. And I'm tired. I haven't cried one time. I stopped crying years ago. I am numb. I have been watching police murder people that look like me for years. I'm also a Black history minor. So not only have I been watching it in the 30 years that I've been on this planet, but I've been watching it for years before we were even alive. I'm not sad. I don't want your pity. I want change.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. It's the 86th minute of Alan J. Pakula and Robert Redford's 1976 masterpiece that we've arrived to. We are really on the downhill slope of this movie now. We have gotten some big breaks, and we're watching these two wonderful guys, Robert Redford's Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, bounce off one another some ideas about how to secure some information from a bookkeeper who is done talking to them. And today's a treat because there's a person here who I'm going to read. I don't usually read out like a bio as such, but the terrific critic himself, Scout Tafoya, has the state of film criticism. I don't know what you want to call it, but he basically has this sort of anthology of film criticism that talks about different critics. This person is one of the most hilarious and essential Twitter followers
in my life, and I just relish hearing his voice on Twitter all the time, coming over the top. He's a contributor to Premier Magazine, Movie Mezzanine, some folks would know of, The Dissolve, RIP, The Atlantic, IndieWire, Yahoo Movies. Most importantly, writes for the site of The Great One, RogerEbert.com. And Scout DeFoya writes, he's willing to not go to bat for merely films and artists he admires, but for the idea of a rational, critical conversation. An endangered species at the time of Scout's writing this in 2014, making him a most vital voice. It's my distinct pleasure to welcome a filmmaker and a film critic, Danny Bowes, to All the President's Minutes. Mate, thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Ah, thank you for having me. And that intro, I feel like such an August personage now. And,
Well, look, I'm so glad you could make it to be a part of the show. I'm excited to talk to you. It was one of those things that we finally linked up on Twitter, and I was like, when are you coming on the show? And you're like, when you invite me, Blake. And I was like, that's a very Danny response. I was like, well, you're invited, for God's sake. You've had a standing invite. You never needed to RSVP. Tell me about, you know, I know your writing influences. I know you've got such an eclectic set of tastes, whether it's literally from the sort of formal classicists of film, you know, film history gone to the past, or like Bollywood movies that don't get any attention in the United States. What's your relationship with New Hollywood and Alan J. Pakula, and particularly All the President's Minutes?
Well, I mean, the New Hollywood occupies a very outsized place in American cinephilia, because it was, you know, one of the alternate terms for it is the American New Wave.
Yes.
And every country's New Wave obviously is like, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, man, that was when the shit was going on, man. You know, it's like, and so, like, I think there was never like a particularly localized moment when I came to the New Hollywood. Like, it probably started from like watching The Godfather when I was like 8 years old, or whenever it was I first saw The Godfather. I mean, maybe I was like 10 or something, but like, you know, and then it was just like, you know, gradually as it became like more of a cinephile as a teen, like the movies that I was absorbing were, you know, like Martin Scorsese's films and, you know, the classic, you know, like Robert Altman and Brian De Palma and, you know, Coppola, and just, it's just like the laundry list of American directors. It's like the, like you can list major figures for like an hour, and then there's the, you know, obscurities who are like great directors in their own right and would be like all time greats, you know, no matter how you cut it. And, you know, and I think it was in my 20s, somewhere around there. It was younger than I am now, but like definitely years into becoming a serious cinephile, I found, you know, Alan Pakula's Paranoia trilogy, starting with Clute and then The Parallax View and then All the President's Men. And it's just those three films are such an unbelievable run, and that like so few.
So unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, it ranks with like the great three film runs in all of cinema all over the world. And it's like, the thing that's interesting about it to me is that it's sort of like, you know, like how, I think of him almost like, you know, in terms of like a historical figure, like he's almost like somebody like Michael Curtiz, you know, like who you don't, you know, like when you're talking about, it's like, okay, who are the greatest directors of all time? You start going, it's like, all right, well, you know, Ford, Hawks, Wells, you know, blah, 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 Buñuel, Lang, you know. And then, you know, maybe you don't necessarily think of Curtiz with those guys. He made a handful of some of the most perfect and sublime films that we've ever seen. And you look at them and it's like, this guy's fucking great, you know? You know, and it's like, and I think of Pakula as somebody like that. You're just like, whoa, 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 hold on. Why didn't you tell me about this? This is the shit right here. You know, and especially with, I mean, just the synergy between Pakula and Gordon Willis. I mean, like, those two guys are just, like, all on the same page. It's like, all right, Gordon, I want you to make this look cool. All right, Alan, I'm going to. You know, it's like, and then the whole goddamn film just, and you're just like, oh, this is so good! Ah!
when you think of Gordon Willis, like, I don't know, like, as a cinephile, you think of him like he must be like a wizard. Like, he talks like in your head, he talks like Gandalf the Grey. Like, he's just like imparting all this like poetic wisdom, but he's really a pragmatic workman-like guy, and much like Pakula, just this really pragmatic, engaging, very attentive, normal dude. And so I love your positing how they interact. It's probably exactly correct. Like, it's not even anything to laugh about. It's like, Gordon, do your thing. Sure, Alan. That's it. Like, they just know, like, what's the light in here? Yeah, we've got a lamp. All right, let's go with that. Like, they just do their thing. And, yeah, really a phenomenal pairing that only worked. They seem to work perfectly. It's one of those things that like great director and cinematographer pairings are exciting to me just as a cinephile, and I know you too. But I think when you were talking about Michael Curtiz there, I just thought, I always think those guys who don't get the credit, guys or gals that don't necessarily get the credit or aren't in the first five filmmakers that you make, are always more interesting. They just always seem to be more interesting because on the fringes they continue to make these great films, and then you get to go back and revisit them, and they're like, no, that this is actually great. Like, it's actually in the context of, you know, that entire arc of work or that entire era, like, their films are influential. And then you later find out that the big, you know, all-time great filmmakers were deeply influenced by them or watched their films and admired them and changed their work because of it. That's what's really exciting to me.
Okay. Oh, I just wanted to circle back to what you were saying about Gordon Willis a second ago about his being like a practically minded, you know, like working man kind of guy, because when you contrast the relationship that he had with Pakula, you know, and our, you know, headcanon that they just got along perfectly harmoniously with no bullshit, but, you know, which I think is probably, you know, like fairly close to reality, the relationship that Gordon Willis had with, say, like, you know, Francis Coppola or Woody Allen, who were both sort of like, you know, two variations on New York fancy lads, kind of, you know, and how, like, you know, Coppola could just sit there and, like, you know, fucking filibuster for 3 hours about, like, you know, Joseph Conrad or something like that. And Willis is sitting there going, it's like, yeah, well, how the fuck do you want me to like the shots that the actor's faces are, you know, it's like whatever, you know, it's like, and Coppola, like, once complained about Gordon Willis. He's like, I'm here, I'm an artist, and, you know, Gordy's, you know, like, sitting here looking at all these sissy actors, you know, it's like, I think he, you know, like, used an even more, you know, like, homophobic term to refer to Gordon Willis's attitude towards creative artists. But it's like, and I gotta say, as much as, you know, like, an intellectual and a fancy lad as I am, it's like, I do sympathize with Willis in that dynamic of just sort of like, we got a fucking job to do, man. We got a fucking movie to make. You know, like, we can have, like, our literature paper about, you know, like, all these, you know, grand works of art, you know.
Today, some actor's face needs to be lit, Francis, for you to capture it on film, on celluloid. They need to be lit. And they need to not move off my marks once I set them, you know, or I need to light the room differently so that you can shoot them with the fluidity that they need to move around. Like, it's one of those things that in the research of my show and a couple of great combos I've had in this, it's like, people are like, Gordon Willis, it's not the guy that you would imagine perhaps if you've kind of got a romantic vision of what he might be like. He's a very workman guy, like, very craft orientated, very supportive. And yeah, like, at the end of the day, I'm just going to light it. I'm going to light it and make sure it's well lit and exactly to the tone that you want, and then you're going to shoot it. And so, yeah, it's really funny that they had such a great kinship, because I think it says a lot about them.
Right, because Pakula himself was like a very kind of nuts and bolts guy. Like, I think he's one of the guys who started in the 50s doing live TV, like Sidney Lumet and Arthur Penn and that generation of guys who, you know, and when you cut your teeth in that sort of process where it's like, all right, you know, like, we don't have any time, we got to get it, and we got to get it right, let's do it. You end up developing a kind of, you know, attitude towards creation that is, while still retaining any, you know, like, you know, artistic ambitions that you have, ultimately the execution has to be just like, you can't dither, you got to just go.
Yeah.
And I think
There's no art in it. It's like function. Like, with that live TV, it's like, get the job done. Like, the setups are easy. the choreography of the cameras is more important. Like, we've got a standard set. It's like, get the job done. There's not, you're not going to wax lyrical to a live TV director about the art that you want to portray in the of a shot. It's just like, it's very workmanlike. So those guys tend to then have a greater appreciation. You talk about Lumet too. I think he and Pakula share a lot in terms of just the awareness of what they're shooting in conjunction with how it's going to be edited and the tempo that they can set in any of their pictures, because they kind of don't seem to have a wasted, you know, not a wasted frame in the movies that they really, really sort of hit out of the park, especially.
Because they've got the conception of the thing and the execution of the thing working in harmony, that it's not like, you know, because all too many directors, I'm sure, you know, we can pull examples of this, but, you know, why slander people when we're here to praise All Presidents Men. But, you know, like other kinds of directors who are just walking around going, I have a vision, and you peons are tasked with bringing my vision to life. And, you know, it's like the whole crew sitting there going, man, fuck this. You know, it's like, this guy sucks. You know, and those sets tend to just be awful. And it's like, and everybody thinks, it's like, oh, man, I would have loved to have been on set when that was happening. It's like, no. You want to be on set with a bunch of, like, practically minded, clock-punching fucking guys making, like, a creature feature, you know, where it's like, you do three takes of everything, you have lunch at 12, and, you know, it's like, you go home in, like, 4 weeks, and you have a good-ass movie. Instead of, like, going to the Philippine jungle for 2 years while everybody's dying of a heart attack and shit, you know, it's like, and having to have, like, audiences at the presidential palace with fucking, you know, like, Ferdinand and Imelda Marcos, you know, being like, well, if we like the film, we won't kill you, you know, and it's like...
One of my favorite things, and when you send John Milius as an envoy to be the voice of reason, then
you're not fucked up somewhere, yeah.
The whole thing is a garbage fire. Like, just it's over. Yeah, it's over. But no,
yeah,
when you want
people to agree on things, send Walter Sobchak. Yeah,
right. He can get you a tow. He can get you a tow, and that's yeah. Sure. I totally agree. I think that, and that's what Lumet does. He makes these really, like, philosophically dense morality plays, but he makes them with real efficiency because of the way that he, you know, stringently rehearses at the beginning. And then when they get on set, they know, everyone knows what they're doing. Like, they just, everyone's like, we know what this is going to look like. We know what it's going to do. This is going to happen. And that, you know, I haven't had a chance to see it yet. And I've been reading articles about it and talking to a few people who've seen it. And there's apparently a really great, Alan J. Pakula retrospective documentary about his career and a lot of the people that work with him, and has an incredible lineup of his collaborators past all through his life, talking about him, just talking about what he was, because obviously he's one of these sort of fringe figures, if you like, in the Hollywood history. Okay. And they consistently just say, like, his attentiveness, his attention to detail and knowing what he wants, and just really, like, being able to almost hypnotically focus in on his performers in their scenes and really give them what they need to execute on the day. Mm-hmm. It's just what they always talk about. So it's just like, yeah, you don't want the, I think we all kind of, it's in our gut, we wish that we could, that those people were actually rational human beings, but that example of a crazy director is like, they never seem like they're going to be fun to work with.
No. And that's what the appeal of, like, you know, say, you know, your Pakulas and your Lumets, you know, have, is that, like, you know, they take film seriously as an art form.
Yes.
They get the job done while they're making the thing. And then when it's done, you're watching this, you know, like, a fully realized film that, like, pretty much, like, you know, that, like, a broad variety of people can appreciate for a number of different reasons, or for all those reasons put together. You know, because it's also with the, you know, the background that guys like that came from, you know, like, growing up, like, I think Pakula is a New Yorker as well, but I know Lumet was. But, yeah, like, coming from working class urban backgrounds, where they're growing up around, like, a variety of different kinds of people, It's, you know, not the way it is now where all too many filmmakers are breaking in. It's like kids who are rich enough to be able to hone their filmmaking chops by the time they're 22. Yeah. So, you know, like the cinema of recent years is a lot of times the cinema of rich kids. But in their generation, it was like, you know, they knew what they were tapped into what, you know, the average person, you know, like wanted to see in a movie. So they would make a movie that was accessible to everybody. So you could watch one of these films and not feel like there was all this, like, you know, symbolism and pretension flying over your head. You would understand exactly what, you know, somebody like, you know, Pakula was saying about, you know, like institutions, or somebody, you know, like, you know what I'm saying? I'm kind of running out of steam here with the workbook, but, you know, like, we're basically, you know, it's like we share a respect for this kind of, you know, almost like, you know, working class filmmaking kind of, you know.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I think there's like a sort of no fuss element, you know, there's romanticism of the Hearts of Darkness that is there, that, you know, you know, out of the clutches of 2 years of madness, you can pull a masterpiece, and far too few times that is actually the case. More often than not, it's, you know, too much chaos reeks of a production that is bad, and then the movie's bad, and then the creative process is bad for everyone, and no one gets anything out of it. But that's one thing I've really learned to appreciate throughout this whole process, is just him being a really practical, working, you know, obsessive, but not to the point that it hinders the work that he's doing, which is, you know, it only complements it. We're in a banger of a scene here, Danny. I've asked you to be part of a line now that has come up. I didn't realize it was one of the lines of the movies, but I Don't Want a Cookie is appearing to be one of the lines of the movie that people have sought after, and you get the minute with that moment. Would Cena together conferring over the manic notes taken by Bernstein during the bookkeeper scene, which played by the Oscar-nominated Jane Alexander. We have this great exchange. They are going back and forth. And this is kind of the bridging scenes, sort of a dialogue action scene, the coda at the end that you're getting, and then us heading back to the bookkeeper. So let's watch this now, the 86th minute of this great movie, which for anyone queuing it up on their HBO Max or on their Blu-ray, it's 1 hour 25 minutes on the dial, up to 1 hour 26. Danny and I are going to watch it together now. You guys are going to listen along, and then we're going to come back and talk about it.
And what if she denies it?
We're screwed.
So?
But if she doesn't, we know we've got it. We know P is Porter.
Try it.
Hi.
They'll see you.
Not if you let us in, they won't. And I'm Bob Woodward.
They'll see your car.
We parked around the corner.
You have answers for everything, don't you?
If we did, we wouldn't be here.
You wrote what I told you.
Oh, no, not your name. No one knows it was you.
Could you tell us who got the money and how much?
You mean, like, what did you do with 25 grand, lady?
What?
Little jokes they're making down at finance these days.
If people are to be convinced that Stans and Sloan are innocent, then our reporting must be precise, and you can help us. Who is
P, Danny? Who is P?
Yeah, who was... was it Paulson?
P is Porter. No,
he is Porter. He is Porter. Yeah.
We bury it so they can't see it.
Yeah.
Such a really nice contrast to those scenes. The coda. You get the beginning line, which is great. We're screwed. If she doesn't buy it, there's been a little negotiation about how they're going to approach their next interrogation of their source, and then we get a great scene to see the. A remaining calm Bernstein and a much more assertive Bob Woodward here, asking the questions and allowing Bernstein to sit silently and play good cop in the background.
Yeah, that reversal is interesting, because for most of the film, you know, Bernstein's the one who's just like, you know, humping everybody's leg to be, you know, first of all, to be allowed to be part of the story, and then just like the like when he's down in Florida trying to get in to see Ned Beatty, he's just like, you know, sitting around all day, and he's just like, you know, that 8 cups of coffee, Dustin Hoffman energy, just like, well, you know, it's like, I'm not leaving here. And the whole time, you know, it's like Redford's the one who gets to be all chill, and it's like, you know, the guy who says to him, it's like, well, I'm a Republican, and, you know, like, and Redford goes, oh, I am too. You know, it's like, and Hoffman gives him that triple take, you know, it's all that shit. Yeah, and then this one, it's, you know, Woodward's the one who's like, yeah, let's go. Yeah, let's do the thing. And Bernstein's almost like, oh, wow, I can take a couple minutes off, you know.
Yes.
The thing that fascinated me about the lead into this scene and the way that, you know, that it plays out as a result is how many times in the film they have to do these things where they have to, like, trick people into, you know, it's almost like a courtroom drama where, like, they have to, you know, it's like, you know, like, manipulate language to get the other person into a position where they can say the thing without, you know, literally risking their lives. Yes. And just that dance that they're constantly doing in the movie, just all through text is really fascinating. And it's, you know, you think of most films when people talk about, it's like, oh, something is like, you know, oh, it's really talky. They're usually saying that it's boring. And in this, the role of dialogue and the role of language is a large part of what creates the suspense because of all that's at stake. And that language is the only tool that these guys who are, you know, like writers, and as writers, they have kind of shady people skills sometimes. And so it's like the relentlessness kind of like makes people uncomfortable. And then they have to make sure that they don't make the person too uncomfortable to just shut down. And in this scene, the look that she gives them when they roll up, she's like, God damn it. What, like, why the fuck are you assholes back here? God damn, get the fuck out of here. You know? And it's like, and all conveyed in like a fucking like eyebrow raise and a sigh too. It's like that, it's very an efficiency of gesture, but the subtext just like screams out, just like, if I never see this Carl Bernstein motherfucker in my life again, oh, die happy. And yet there he is with his blonde friend showing up, and it's like, great. It's
like, and I love it. Like, she's like, oh, you printed what I told you. And he's like, well, we didn't mention you as a source. And I love the inference, though, of they're like, you didn't print me as a source, but you may as well have. Like, you know, like, but she's way too polite. She's literally talking to them over an iced tea. So the politeness level is significantly enhanced. But yeah, the subtext of the scene is like, I don't want to talk to this guy. This is a pain in my ass. And now I'm just relaxing. I've finally been like feel free and comfortable to be out of my house because at least maybe some of the pressure is off me. It's like two different people from the one that we saw like hold up in the house, not wanting to leave, but she's got this little sanctuary moment, and then they just bluster in there as well and bother her, you know, oh, they won't see us if you won't let us in. And like you said, there's a great, like, there's like a targeted manipulation in every one of those exchanges that is reminiscent of a courtroom drama, because you're like, you want to basically put people into a corner where they have to tell you what they know, even though it might damage their reputation or something like that, or they may sort of incriminate themselves slightly or bear themselves to some kind of additional scrutiny, if you like.
And there's that ethical element of it too, that they have to factor into all of these interactions with these people where they're trying to get to go on the record, because if they were purely ruthlessly relentless in pursuit of this information, they wouldn't have to, you know, like, care about the personal safety of the people who they're talking to. And so they have to do this. They have to balance, you know, like, if I print this person's name in the newspaper, they could literally be killed.
Yes.
You know, and they have to keep that in mind while they're relentlessly pursuing the information. And it's like, they, for the most part, pull it off, but that's another source of the great suspense in this movie. I mean, the suspense in this movie is unreal. Like, every single moment, even quiet things where nothing's happening, it's like a shot with, like, one person walking up the street. You're, like, on the edge of your seat, your teeth are, like, clenched, and you're just like, heart's palpitating. You're like, and it's just because there is so much at stake. And it's like, there's the, I'm going to fuck up the quote, but like later on when like, you know, Ben Bradley tells him, it's like, you know, it's like, you know, nothing's riding on this except the First Amendment, the whole future of the history. And it's like, oh yeah, right. This is kind of, yeah, you know what I'm saying?
I think we've come to that crest of, there's a whole stack of time in this movie where they're not quite sure how big this thing is. And in the preceding scenes to this minute, we've now just gone, oh no, it's not only is it way bigger and way more influential people are culpable for this, you know, political, like internal political espionage, domestic political espionage. It's now that not only is it way bigger than we ever thought, but if all of those guys are involved, it's even bigger. Like there's more. And I think that's the cresting wave here, is because now literally almost every moment in the film, exactly as you said, like it is, you are on the edge of your seat. Like every person they're talking to, every story they get, everything, it is an avalanche happening. And that's what I love, is because they start to become aware well before the, you know, infamous deep throat scene where he's like, your lives are in danger. And then there's that great interplay where he's passing on messages on the typewriter while Bernstein's listening to, you know, opera. But I think they're starting to know the stakes, and especially when they go and visit Hugh Sloan, there's that beautiful line, which I am going to get to in the minute that's coming up, which is, you know, they're both walking down the street and she's like, you know, can you believe that, you know, there are people, you know, behind these dark suburban, you know, behind these bright suburban streets that, you know, something nasty is going on. And Woodward's like, yeah, I can believe it. And you're like, oh, yeah, okay. That may as well just be the exegesis of the movie, is that like three lines and then walking down the street and going, there's, you know, something wicked is happening behind this, you know, lovely facade of what America thinks it is.
Well, and it's also like the interesting thing about the arc of realization in the movie is that when it starts out, you know, like, and there's the, you know, third rate burglar at the Watergate Hotel, you know, the famous phrase, you know, it's like, and then, you know, both, or I think like Bernstein at the beginning of the movie is like, wouldn't it be fucked up if like Nixon was involved in this, man? That would be trippy, right? Yeah, like if fucking Nixon was involved, you know, everybody else is like, shut up, you dumbass. That's not the way things work. And then like by halfway through the movie, he's like, even he didn't know, you know, because he's not walking around with his dick out saying, I told you so, because it's like, he didn't know. He was just saying, wouldn't it be cool? And then all of a sudden it manifests in real life. He had to, like, especially with the amount of coffee he was drinking, that shit had to fuck him up. You know, just being like, oh shit, man, did I think this into reality? Fuck, maybe I need to take a Valium or something. You know, it's like, you know, it's like the thing, it's like you get high enough and all of a sudden you think your brain is like manifesting reality. Yeah.
Is one of my cigarettes acid dipped? Because this is all too fucked up. This is all too
real.
How did we get here? Yeah, like it's such a fantasy at the beginning. And then you're like, you know, in that great William Goldman line, follow the money. It's just like, oh, actually, that's it. That's what it is. Like, it's all over the top. It's going even further than we thought.
Like, that line became the mantra for understanding American life forever after, because it's like, when there is a huge scandal like this with enormously powerful people involved, follow the money and you'll find the truth, you know? And
I think that's, you know, it's funny that Goldman said, like, discovered that line, because even investigative journalists have had it on the show. Like, you and I can talk about it from like how it's rippled through history, and when there are controversies. Okay. But like, even investigative journalists are like, yeah, that's a really great foundational question to have in your head when you're like looking
for. Right, it's like, literally, you're like, shit, that's good advice, actually. Thanks, Bill.
It actually kind of encapsulates what we're doing. It's like, you follow the money because it's an easy thing to follow, because you've got a paper trail, because you've got something that you follow, and you can, you know, if someone's bank account swells up, and you know, even in something as trivial as like, in Australia, we've got, you know, one of our most popular sports is rugby league, and just like in the NFL, you have a salary cap, and there's been lots of salary cap, let's just say what it is, fuckery, basically, for many years, where like someone gets paid $1 million on their contract and that's what it says, and then their sister miraculously gets $30,000 from, you know, a branch of that organization, and their mum gets another $30,000 a year from this organization, and they're cut, and, you know, and it's like big sort of cheating and rorting the salary cap has been found out from, like, literally following the money. So it's just one of those funny things that, like, it literally plays out in all forms of journalism of all topics ever since this moment.
Right. And, you know, it's like in another great film, as Danny DeVito once said, everybody wants money. That's why they call it money. You know, it's like, and that's the other reason why following the money gets you over.
Waiting on a tax return. Hopefully it ends up in your hands. Fraudulent tax returns due to identity theft increased by 30% in 2023. If you're in a bind this tax season, LifeLock can help. Our U.S.-based restoration specialists are experts dedicated to helping solve your identity theft issues. And all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. So we'll reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. Help protect your information this tax season with LifeLock. Save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/aware.
It's like, you know, everybody's looking for it somewhere. Yeah.
So we've got this scene. We've got these guys playing off. Again, another beautiful, beautifully composed Gordon Willis shot of the sort of like the blurred, not a diopter, a blurred foreground shot of the tea and the table and this beautiful, I don't know, it looks like a bit of a halo of like trees that are surrounding this house that feels like comfortable. No one can be seen. And then the guys sort of, again, blustering in corduroy and short sleeves and ties for her. But it's just the beginning of, you know, the tragedy of this show is that we cut off or crowbar you into in between great scenes. And I feel like we get the very end moment of what is a terrific scene, and we get just the ramp up to what is another great scene of this movie, which is like them actually showing off their very deliberate sort of, you know, interrogation techniques that they've planned about who's going to say what and who's going to play what role, and seeing these guys actually form their relationship. It's, I feel like in this moment, these guys are these guys more than any other moment.
Right.
You know, like, I don't know what it is about it, Danny. I was going to talk to you about it, and I was watching it in preparation. I was watching it last night. I was watching it this morning before we talked. And I'm like, I feel like this is the most Woodward is in the movie almost, and the most Bernstein, where it's effortless. Like, there's no show, there's no nine coffee energy. It's just like they're there as these characters talking to this woman with their plan of how they want to extract the information from her, and here it is. It's right in front of you. But it's nonetheless really compelling, really phenomenally acted, just really great work.
Oh, yeah, and you're absolutely right about this being a very unguarded and very revealing moment for who both of them are, because one of the things that happens a lot over the course of the movie is that as dedicated as Woodward is to the story, he's also essentially like a people pleaser and a social climber who values status. Yes. This is something that we've seen play out in real life since then. I mean, Bob Woodward at this point in history is essentially kind of like a prestige puppy dog for administrative power in D.C. Like, you know, every single time he writes a new one of these tell-all books, he gets access to literally everybody.
Yes.
And then he puts out the book, and there's nothing really all that consequential in it. Because I recently rewatched, I watched All the President's Men like a couple weeks ago, which is why I didn't have to rewatch it again for this, because it's still really fresh in my memory. One of the things that struck me watching it that time was that, and I think it was like, you know, Woodward announced that he was like writing a book about Trump, and it was, the thought just crossed my mind, it's like, if Bob Woodward was still worth the shit as an investigative journalist, somebody would have assassinated him by now.
Oh yeah,
because he has been riding on Watergate for 45 years. You know, I mean, and like, you know, I'm like, I'm not saying that the guy hasn't done a goddamn thing since then. Like, he's had a career as a journalist, and it's like, you know, they haven't, like, you know, fired him for slacking off yet or anything, but it's like he hasn't done anything as earth shattering as this since then, which is kind of unfair because, I mean, Watergate is pretty big, you know. Yeah. And it's like it, no matter who you are, it's going to be the biggest story of your career. But it's like Woodward has become safe at this point. And it's, you can see the seeds of that in the movie in Redford's performance, because Redford, like, he has the, you know, Redford's iteration of Woodward, you know, has this very, like, like WASP institutional, you know, like he'd be right at home at a garden party, like, you know, sipping gimlets with like, you know, people in the social register and like playing croquet and like, you know, those whole like very, you know, Great Gatsby kind of scenes, you know, it's like he's right at home in that world. And that's one of the contrasts between Bernstein, is that Bernstein is very just like, I'm Jewish and I'm from the city and I'm like, I'm from the, you know, I'm from the street, I'm from baseline reality. And yeah. Woodward is like, I'm WASP country club aristocracy.
Yeah. I'm cycling around the city. I'm on the street. You're driving around. You're very comfortable with these people. You don't want to tread on, you don't want to offend anyone. And Bernstein is the complete inverse of that, which is like a nice, it's a nice yang, you know, to his yin, which is like, no, I'm going to, if we have to tread on people's toes, we're going to do that. That's what's going to happen.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing in the scene that we watched, is that there is that slight inversion of that, because whether because he's tired or stressed out or what, I think, like, if I remember correctly, Woodward has been up for, like, a couple days straight, like, when this scene starts. And, like, he's been subsisting entirely on, you know, coffee and fear and ambition. And he gets into this scene, and he's a lot more aggressive than he usually is, and not like in an off-putting kind of way, but in a very honest way. Like, yeah, that the realest thing about Bob Woodward, and I should specify about Redford's iteration of Woodward, although I think this is also true of the real Woodward, is his ambition. That ambition is his defining trait. And he is just like, he has awareness that if he plays this right and he's, you know, firm but not overbearing, he'll get the information that he wants out of this person.
Yes.
And so that's just how he plays it. He just shows up and he's like calm, and he's making an effort to be calm because, like, his, probably in his mind, he's like, you know, hallucinated shit out of the corners of his eyes because he's been up for two straight days, you know, but he's holding it all together. And he's like, because I know I can't be off-putting, but part of him is like, ah, oh, I mean, I'm a good-looking blonde guy. If I just, like, you know, manage to sort of maintain, you know, this woman is be like, oh, he's handsome, I'll tell him stuff, you know, or whatever, you know, or it's like, or he seems like a nice boy. Like, he seems like, oh, he's an F. Scott Fitzgerald character. Of course I can trust him, you know. But, you know, so it's like there isn't that, that performative, like, people-pleasing thing that he's doing when he's around, like, you know, his higher-ups at the Washington Post, or when he's interviewing, like, you know, powerful men or whatever. It's like, I don't know. And it seems, like you said, you pointed out very astutely, that it is a very honest moment from him. And Bernstein is just sort of like, you know what? The natural order of things is that this guy is the aristocrat and he's the star and I'm the working man. So it's like, I'm just, instead of pushing back against that, it won't kill me to defer to him for like 2 seconds and just sort of calmly let him play this out. Because it's also, it's like the strategy that they discussed for how to play the scene. It's like Woodward is the one who is going to have to take the reins and sort of like take the lead in orchestrating the conversation that they want to have to get her to say the thing that they want.
And
yeah.
Excuse me. And the big one is Hoffman has done so good to repress his instincts with her to extract the story that it would be so weird for him to come in and be blustery Bernstein, you know, like in this moment. So like right. when they're talking about the strategy, it's like, well, you kind of have to, like, he's like, you kind of have to take the lead. I have to be the guy that sits there because I, and after spending 6 hours with one person to try and extract all this information, he's like, I clearly can't get any more out of her. So
right, and it would be overkill, yeah.
It's like,
because both of them being really smart guys is something that comes through a lot in the movie and in very, very strongly in this scene. Yeah.
I mean, that at this point, you know, I don't know about you, Danny, but like on movies I like to rewatch, I love scenes where you then, it's just one of those things. It's hard to pick up on the first time that you view it, but every other scene that they then have for the rest of the movie, even though you don't get to see them do a strategy planning session, you know, in a way as we have in the previous scene, you now imagine that they do that for every scene. You know, you imagine right. that they've already done it. So I love now revisiting, like, from this point on exactly in the movie, every time that they talk to someone new, I'm like, I want to imagine how they planned that scene. And if they
did. Yeah, they had a strategy session the night before. And the thing about the narrative efficiency of the movie is that it doesn't need to show you every single one of those scenes the way that, like, a modern movie would do that, where it's like, oh, well, I mean, we can't assume anything. We have to spoon-feed the audience all the information. You know, Pakula's there. It's like, we did it once, all right? Let's just, like, nah, let's keep it moving. Everybody wants to see Nixon get impeached. They don't want this bullshit. You know, it's like, yeah, it's like, the audiences are in the seats because they want to see Nixon go down. You know,
oh, my God. I just love that guy. I want to see that guy when the movie ends with the teletype. He's like, what the hell is this movie? What the hell did I just watch for 2 hours? Oh, my God.
Oh, it's so great, though, because that moment, man, at the teletype one, because the next last thing is like, Nixon's like, yeah, fuck this. I ain't going to resign. And it's like 2 days later, Nixon resigns. And at that point, watching the movie, because the, like, pretty much, like, the entire movie has just been holding your breath because it's all so tense and so perfectly calibrated to be this, like, just on, like, to capture the intensity of living through those times. The same thing, like, I talk about this movie with, you know, like, with my mom, who was around back then, and, like, you know, following the story fanatically, you know, in the papers. And she was just like, yeah, no, the whole time, the way that movie feels is the way life felt for a couple of years while that story was in the papers, you know, and just like, at the end of the movie, when the teletype says, you know, like, President Nixon resigns, you know, President Gerald Ford to take the oath of office, you're just like, whew! And it's just like one big exhale. It's such a brilliant way to do it, too, because it's like, you know, and again, it's like another device taking the place of the one that you normally expect, because you normally expect, like, you know, a big action climax, and then the denouement is sort of like, you know, holding your breath. Like, the big action climax is, you know, Woodward and Bernstein sitting at their typewriters, you know, like, filing copy, and then it's the super loud teletype, you know, just like hammering in at the end. But the sound design, the loudness of the teletype, like, keeps you in it, because you're just like, oh yeah, no, this shit is mad loud, this is still and then it's like Nixon resigns, and you're like, holy fuck. You know, because it's like, the idea that the fucking president of the United States would, like, resign over being involved in some, like, you know, it, like, people's minds were blown when that happened in real life. And it kind of broke the brains of a lot of American journalists after that, because they were either expecting, okay, we're never going to have a scandal ever again of this, remotely this magnitude, or every single time anything happens, we have to treat it like it's Watergate. And so it's like the push and pull between those two very flawed ways of approaching journalism have meant that a whole lot of insane shit has happened in the United States since then. And the media has done a really bad job of handling most of it. You know?
Yes.
Like, Ronald Reagan selling weapons to, like, right-wing guerrillas in Central America, like, was like the equivalent of something like, I mean, it's a bigger crime than, like, breaking into an office, you know. But it was like, oh, yeah, I mean, we can't flip out. I mean, this is no Watergate. And it's like, no, this is actually, like, worse, you know. Yeah.
And then
Bill Clinton got a blowjob. Oh, man, this is worse than Watergate. And it's like, no, he got his dick sucked. Like, just, let's have, like, some perspective here.
Yeah. Like, is it worse than doing that? And it is a funny ebb and flow how that goes, because I in the show a few times I've talked about the guy who got the I grab her by the pussy tape must have gone like, this is my Watergate. Like, this I'm gonna be Woodstein, a solo Woodstein. This is mine. And then that just evaporated into nothing. And so I'm consistently shocked about just the way things are reported. It's not exclusive to your country. It's absolutely mine. I just want to go on a brief aside to talk about, like, ridiculousness. So one of the states in Australia is currently on a really strict COVID lockdown because they had really the worst outbreak in our entire country. So a lot of borders are closed, and they've got, like, stage 5 lockdowns and curfews and things like that to curb it. And they were doing it for 6 weeks, and they've gone about 3 weeks into it now. I think it was 6 to 8 weeks, and they're about halfway through, and you know, their numbers are going down significantly. There's still some deaths, but you know, the whatever actions that they're taking are causing, you know, some positive things for people's well-being. And one of our morning shows, which all morning shows, if you're a morning magazine show, you suck. Like garbage, right? And one of the morning shows was talking about how that southern state, Victoria, wasn't rolling out a Disney toy in supermarkets down there until after the lockdown is done. And we're complaining with the premier, like who's essentially like a governor, going, oh, look at this guy. He won't let us have Disney. And I just wrote to them on Twitter, as you do, and I just went, great. Disney toy or kill grandma? You choose. Like, fucking morons. Like, people are just so, like, that's not what's happening. Look what's right in front of you. So it's either death or a Disney toy. Who gives a shit about the Disney toy? Like, let's think about all the lives that are being saved. Like, that day on one of their news bulletins, they're like, oh, and another 12 deaths from the coronavirus in Victoria overnight and 220 new cases. Anyway, Disney, why can't my kids get a toy in Victoria? Why can't they go to the market? It's just like, what? I don't understand how your brain still works or whether you've been lobotomized by morning TV, but... like, I don't know. The wild thing is
that you're still better off than we are in terms of, like, no matter how dumb shit in Australia gets. And it's like, and I know, like, you know, a number of Australian people, like, through Twitter, and it's like when they talk about, like, the way Australian politics are, and it's like, that's pretty dumb, and you do have some pretty racist, pretty right-wing politicians, but, like, you guys are still better off than we are. It's like, we have you beat in stupidity. We have you outflanked on the right by several miles. You know, it's like, and the thing is like, this is all part of the discussion that we're having relating to all the president's men, because all of this ultimately does kind of come back to a failure, institutional failures of journalism to, you know, to keep the public properly informed about what's going on, what's dangerous, what your priorities are. You know, it's like, what's important, what isn't.
Yes.
Because it's, you know, we're in an era where people are largely choosing which facts to believe, whether they choose to exist in baseline reality with, you know, objectively observable events and statistics that are related to actual things that are happening. Or you can just turn to the fun channel where it's like, nope, all that's bullshit. Trump's doing a great job. And you're like, wait, how are you, what are you basing this on? It's like, what are you questioning me for? What are you, some kind of gay communist? And it's like, well, yeah, but like, that's not the point, you know, it's like.
Well, yes, I am a gay communist, but that wasn't part of.
What the fuck does that have to do with anything? Tell me the thing. It's like, no, but it's like, you know, when you see like, you know, polls between the two major political parties in the States, and it's like. Like, you know, 90% of Democrats believe that, like, you know, COVID-19 is a serious problem.
Yes.
And then, like, 57% of Republicans believe that it's okay. And it's like, those aren't the only two slices of demographics in the country. I mean, there are people, God help us, who are farther to the right than the institutional Republican Party. And there are a whole lot of people who are completely left out of the, you know, all decision-making process in this country, who are to the left of the Democrats. But that's a really fucked up divide. And it's like, and it has to do with, you know, how just, you know, the differing and disingenuous interpretations of the First Amendment of our Constitution, which guarantees, you know, free speech. I mean, obviously.
Yeah, and
I don't want to assume that people know that, and you know, in other countries we just toss around our jargon, but it's like, but like the disingenuous interpretations of like what free speech means, it's meant that, you know, like corporations essentially have bought immunity from all consequences because money is speech somehow.
Yes,
and it's that a news station can effectively lie to people in the guise of saying it's like we're presenting a different perspective, and it's like, yeah. You are presenting a different perspective. It's called shit that isn't real, you know?
Yeah. It's factually inaccurate. That's, and also, there's that duty of care, you know. There's something that happens in this movie where it's like the care and the pride to be telling the truth and to be talking, saying factually accurate statements, and even, you know, orchestrating overlapping weird techniques to, you know, to achieve the goal of making sure that whatever the person is saying to you is factually accurate so that you can then go take it to print. All of those things, and then find sources to back that information up and all those sorts of things. It just seems like sometimes the kind of magazine sort of panel show, 24-hour news cycle, whether it's both, you know, right down the line of like just like backing whichever political party is in power, or like this, you know, your strange like Fox News propaganda that just like provides, you know, I love that phrase, you know, alternative facts, is just so dumb. It's oxymoronic, you know, and underline the moron in the middle of that. It's just like, it doesn't make any sense that it's like, oh, well, you know, you if you look at it from this perspective with no facts, and the facts perspective is the other side. But that's the kind of balm of this movie, is that they're so, even though they're playing all these games to try and get the information, once they actually have it, they then have to source it, you know. And like Bradley will go, okay, well, cool, you've gotten that confession, now go confirm it with four sources in some instances. And they're like, god damn it. But that at least promoted that these are our sources, these are all the facts that are associated with it, this is why you need to know about it. And that tenacity to like take a story that no one cared about to be the most important story in the country is a sort of ethos that seems like completely missing. And then I often wonder with Fox News, is like, if the Republicans lose the election at the end of the year, and they've become so corrupted by this whole reality TV bully president act, that is completely amoral and like, you know, stoking the fires of conspiracy theories and all this other weird shit, like, how do they just, what's day two like when he's not the leader anymore of that party? Like, I just wonder, like, what are they going to do? Like, what are they going to do sitting around at a table together and go, all right, we've just hitched our wagon to this guy and it's now over. Like, are we even relevant anymore? Like, I don't understand.
Well, I mean, in practical terms, what they're going to do is just continue to deny the reality of the situation. And yeah, what's most likely to happen is that, you know, if current trends hold, you know, like Biden is going to win by, you know, an extraordinary amount in the popular vote, and he's probably going to eke out, like, you know, like a narrow but definitive win in the Electoral College.
Yes.
But Trump is going to get up there when the returns come in and just be like, this is fake news, this is bullshit.
Yes.
And they're going to play that for as long as they can.
Yes.
They're just going to deny reality and just be, and claim electoral fraud, which is something that the only cases in which it's been proven has been like Republican governors denying legally registered voters the right to vote.
Yes.
But they claim that there's this vast conspiracy to like illegally register like more, you know, like people to, you know, like the Democratic Party and non-Republican affiliations than there are, you know. It's like, it's this vast conspiracy. It's like, you know, expanding the right to vote is, you know, is inherently corrupt. And you can't, you know, asking follow-up questions is just going to yield more bullshit because they don't really have anything to base this on. There's no observable, objective evidence to back up what they're saying. But they've noticed over the last 4 years that that doesn't really matter. They can just yell bullshit. And then, like, the media that's still holding on to whatever, like, you know, desiccated ideal that, you know, Bradley is trying to imbue in Woodward and Bernstein about, like, the more important the information is, the more sources you have to verify it with, because it's more important, it's more important that it be accurate. You know, anybody who's, like, holding on to, like, the Game of Telephone version of that, where it's like, oh, facts should be real, yeah, you know, it's like, you know, they're going to have to, like, go and fact check the claim that, oh, the election is fraudulent. It's like, oh, we need to investigate voter fraud now. And it's like, no, you really don't. I mean, you have, you know, like, it's, you know. But, I mean, I don't know how all this shakes out because, I mean, it's uncharted territory. There's no precedent for it in, you know, because when they, you know, like, when they drew up the you know, the documents that, you know, founded, that are the basis of law in this country, they never factored in the possibility of some guy who was such an asshole that he would just get in office and be like, no, I'm not going to do it. You know, and they were just like, surely any man of rectitude and honor would have the decency to. And that's the thing that's sort of melancholy about All the President's Men now, is that Nixon and all those guys, like, when they got caught, they were like, fuck.
Yeah, I did it.
They were just like, I fucked up. I've disgraced myself. I'm resigned. You know, all this, like, admission of culpability and, like, admission of guilt. And, you know, an admission that penitence was a necessary thing is the thing, actually, that probably dates this movie more than, like, the hairstyles or needing to go to a phone booth or the cars or anything like that. It's the idea that Nixon would just be like, oh, okay, the jig is up, I'll resign. It's like Trump has had, like, 30 things that have been impeachable or, like, on this level. It's like one of the reasons why the grab him by the pussy thing didn't take is that, like, he had accusations that he'd, like, raped a 16-year-old girl, like, going on at exactly the same time. There was, you know, all of the Russia shit, which is still a huge fucking mystery, because it's like, you know, it's at once more serious and not as serious as people are saying and everything, because it's like the idea that it's like, you know, Boris and Natasha cloak and dagger Cold War shit is utter bullshit. But it's like they've poured massive amounts of money into Trump's, you know,
news campaign,
invested in him as an entity. And, you know, it's like, and there is, like, you know, the, you know, quid pro quo going on in some of those dealings, whether or not they're the ones that actually, you know, it's just that he's saturated the scandal market to such a degree that scandal has become completely devalued.
Yes.
And it's gotten to the point where alongside the, you know, kind of simultaneous crusade against truth. So nothing is real and nothing means anything anymore. And nothing is, you know, worthy of, like, you know, introspection and penitence. So I don't know. One of the things that's so great about watching All the President's Men now is that it's like, yeah, this was a story that had a conclusion.
Yes.
And for once, it ended on the side of justice. And, you know, it's like, and I really think that, you know, I mean, back a few years ago, I want to say, like, back in, like, the late 90s, early 2000s, I remember, I think it was David O. Russell was being an asshole, I'm surprised, in an interview about, it was when Steven Soderbergh like won the Oscar for Traffic.
Yes.
And he gave this interview to the New York Times where he was talking about one of his favorite movies was All the President's Men. And Russell, who was not representing a particularly minority opinion among, you know, like, cinephiles and movie fans at the time, like, went on this whole thing about just like, All the President's Men, you're a fucking nerd. You are such a fucking, just like, you are so uncool. That movie is such a fucking dad movie. You know, it's like, that movie is just, it's safe. It's like, it's just like, it's just a safe, normal ass, boring fucking movie. You know, just going off on this whole thing. And it, that wasn't like a unique perspective. People were like, oh yeah, Soderbergh's lost his edge. He's talking about All the President's Men. And I think the reason why that movie's reputation has appreciated over the years is because, I mean, first of all, it is, like, formal perfection. And, you know, that's a whole side discussion about some people's appreciation of cinema, you know, is, like, the mistakes and the messiness and, like, you know, big swings for the fences, whether or not they're successful or not. They Yes. value that over formal perfection. But if formal perfection is something that I think needs to be acknowledged, and whether or not it's your highest value, it's something that does need to be valued, because if it was so easy to be formally perfect, how come so few movies have ever achieved that?
Yes.
You know, and then extra texturally, because of the political landscape in America, it's like, fuck, that was the last time that the bad guys got caught.
Yeah, or the last time that the bad guys had consequences because they've been caught.
Yeah.
But now now they've got a whole news network that just like backs them up on their lies. And you're like, there are recordings, there are facts, here's documents, here's sworn witness statements that this person did something wrong. And then everyone's like, nah. I never knew that this was a defense. Nah. Like, nope.
Well, the sad thing is that really where it all kind of passed the point of no return is when Ronald Reagan was running for the presidency in 1980 and he sabotaged the negotiations about the Iranian hostage crisis that Jimmy Carter was trying to negotiate. And in sabotaging the negotiations, Reagan was able to look, it's like, look, Jimmy Carter can't even handle this shit. I'm going to bring our Americans back home. And then he just kicked the shit out of Carter in the election and never got caught. And then in his second term, the Iran-Contra thing, which was like, you know, which is just, you're just like, unfucking believable that there were no consequences, or that, you know, like, there was like, what do you mean there's no consequences? A couple people stepped down from their positions, and it's like, yeah, and then they had better jobs 5 years later. You know, Oliver North was like on Fox News making millions of dollars, you know, like as a Fox News contributor. And it's like, so the only reason why Fox News was possible was because it had become clear that there were no consequences for, you know, crimes, you know, like as long as you're a certain type of person with enough of the right kind of institutional power, there are no consequences for your actions anymore. And it's such a shame because it's like Watergate showed, it's like you can do it, you know? And anyway, I mean, we could go on about like the state of modern politics and like right-wing fuckery all fucking day, but like everybody gets it, you know? Things are fucked up. I, however, don't subscribe to the notion that everything is permanently fucked just because they're fucked in the moment. Like, I think there's a way out. It's just that reality needs to evolve to the point where we can see the source of the light at the end of the tunnel rather than inferring its existence by, like, you know, the Hubble telescope or whatever, you know? It's like,
You have to feel like you can touch it. And I think that, you know, even in the context of, like, COVID, you know, in Oz, we've seen what happens when you can curb it in our country down to almost nothing. And then sometimes there's an outbreak and then you've got to deal with that and you've got to deal with it seriously for the protection of the people. And there's definitely criticisms to be leveled at the government or journalism and covering it. But it's like, you can see like if the other states have got such a low cases, it's like, oh, there's the light at the tunnel. Like we can go outside again and we can interact with each other again and those things. And that's just like one element. But man, I've had outside of us postulating about the state of the world, I've had just an absolute blast talking this movie with you. The ultimate dad movie.
I'm old enough that that's not a bad thing anymore. You know, it's like, I'm over 40 years old. It's like, a dad movie? Hell yeah, give it to me. You know,
look, I'm a dad of two, and I'm like, it's a dad movie. I'm in. Hell like, yeah. I'm all in. So, but look, Danny Bowes, mate, thank you so much for chatting
to
me.
Thank you for having me, man. It's so nice to just, like, feel like how happy you are to have me on the podcast. I'm like, oh, man. Oh, shit. It warms the heart. You know, I'll say that. Yeah.
Well, you're such a talent and so fun. And the imaginary characters that you've brought to the show today have given me such unbridled joy. And I just love it. So you're a great mind. Danny, where can people find you the most? Is Twitter still the best place to find you to leap off to all the other stuff that you're up to?
Yeah, until lockdown is over. I mean, even though we're not actually locked down, I'm self-imposing lockdown. But until then, Twitter, I'm at Bybos, Bybowes. And any further updates about any future ventures will be that's the source. So
unreal. I love having you on the show. I love having you as a source of much laughter and joy on Twitter, and it's been a real treat. So thanks again.
Thank you, man.
Danny Bowes, oh my goodness, is he not just the funnest? If you want to follow him on Twitter, it's at @bybowes, Bowes. You can find links to his stuff in the description of this show. Absolute treat, and man,
I had a fun time editing this one, listening back to Danny's impressions, especially the his inferred bookkeeper in a monologue is a true highlight. Danny, you're a legend. Thanks for being on the show. Guys, thank you for listening. At ATPM Pod, if you want to follow the show on Twitter, oneheatminute.com to see all of our guests and every show that we've done and about the shows. If you want to follow me, I'm OneBlakeMinute on the socials on Twitter and Instagram. And if you want to reach out, it's mail@oneheatminute.com. And please, if you like the show, no need to donate monetarily, rate, review this bad boy. Go into iTunes, go into your other apps, review us. Even just a couple of sentences about what the show means to you would be a huge help for sharing the show around to new people. Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you on another episode very soon.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.